Blog Talk Radio.
Radio listeners out there, this is Chocolate Lady 64, better known as Lily 44. I love my numbers, but I changed my name. Okay, tonight we will continue our segment on domestic violence, and I want to first start the show off by giving you two numbers. The first number is the Louisiana Hotline for domestic violence. It's 1-800-411-1333. And the national hotline is 1-800-799-SAFE or 1-800-799-7233. Now, I'm hoping that I have been able to touch some people who have been affected in some way by domestic violence with the information that I have been giving out. From my previous shows, we've talked about protective orders. We've talked about how do we handle situations that we get in, what to look for in a batterer. And I want to further continue with that. First of all, let me give you my number to call me by if you're interested in speaking with me or you have any questions. My phone number here is 347-677-1749. Let me repeat that again, 347-677-1749. And tonight we want to talk about domestic violence counts for 2008. Which is a census of domestic violence shelters and services. And then we'll talk about the history of domestic violence or battered women, where it all began. And you'd be surprised the year it all started and the legal ramifications that went with domestic violence. Okay, according to the national summary, on September the 17th, 2008, 78% of identified domestic violence programs in the United States and territories, or 1,553 out of 2,000 programs participated in the 2008 National Census of Domestic Violence Services. The following figures provided by these 1,553 participating programs about services provided during the 24-hour census survey period. We had 60,799 victims served on one day. 30,433 domestic violence victims found refuge in emergency shelters or transitional housing provided by local domestic violence programs. 30,366 adults and children received non-residential assistance and services, including individuals counseling, legal advocacy, and children's support groups. Now, 87% individual support advocacy, 58 children support, 58 legal accompaniment services, 51% of transportation, 46% group support, 33% transitional, and 24% child and daycare. 21,683 hotline calls were answered. Domestic violence hotlines are a lifeline for victims in danger, providing support, information, safety planning, and resources. In the 24-hour survey period, domestic violence programs answered more than 14 hotline calls every minute. There's 30,210 people that was trained. On the survey day, individuals and communities across the United States attended a 1,455 training sessions provided by local domestic violence programs, gaining much-needed information on domestic violence prevention and early intervention. 8,927 unmet requests for services in one day. Many programs reported a critical shortage of funds and staff to fully assist victims in need of services, such as transportation, child care, language translation, mental health and substance abuse, counseling, and legal representation. Over 50% of these unmet requests were services were for, from victims seeking emergency shelter or transitional housing. Most programs operate shelters, hotlines, and outreach services 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. In many areas, domestic violence programs provide a wide variety of services to large geographical areas. Lack of staffing was a key reason many programs could not meet domestic violence victims' requests for services. 70% of programs have less than 20 paid staff, including 38% with less than 10 paid staff. The average starting salary of a full-time salaried frontline advocate is only $24,765. So those are some good numbers to keep in mind. On September the 17th, 2008, a woman sought protection order from her ex-husband who had been released on parole after being in jail for 9 years. When the judge asked her if she was still afraid of him, she replied, "Yes. The only reason I'm still alive today is because his gun jammed." That's devastating. A woman in North Carolina learned that her abuser will only get 3 months of probation despite breaking her arm and threatening her life. A teenage girl in Texas, currently living in a shelter, discovered that she is pregnant after being raped by her stepfather. The staff from a domestic violence program in California attended the funeral of a woman who had been killed by her husband. A woman decided to stay with her abuser because her only other choice was to be homeless. Those are devastating issues. Now, it says also on that same day, more than 60,000 victims of domestic violence with stories like these found refuge, support, and safety at domestic violence programs and shelters across the United States and territories suffering life-threatening and degrading abuse. These victims depend on the immediate and compassionate response of domestic violence programs to help them escape abuse and rebuild their sheltered life. So we understand now how important these shelters are because of the facilities and the resources that they have for these victims. So if you have an opportunity, and I mentioned this in my last show, if you have an opportunity to give to a battered shelter, please do, because there's so many innocent children that are also wrapped up in this big mess. I say big, horrible mess. The economic crisis hits home. A declining economy in the United States in 2008 affected all Americans, but disproportionately affected victims of domestic violence. While a bad economy does not cause domestic violence, it limits resources and services to victims and thereby limits victims' choices and options. Programs reported concern for 2009 as they experienced a decrease in donations and faced funding cuts across the board. Victims will need more resources, but there will be less to give, a California program already reported. Advocates expressed concern for victims of domestic violence because of lack of money and jobs is a barrier to victims who want to leave an abusive relationship. Victims, regardless of their income level, are reluctant to leave their abusers because they're afraid they'll lose their jobs in this time of economic uncertainty and not have the resources for themselves and their children. This is devastating news, and we do know how the economy has affected a lot of people. With, like I also mentioned in my last show, and I know the number has increased since last week, at that time it was 565,000 jobs lost last week. I didn't check the numbers for this week yet. But to me, that number alone is very devastating. So we have to understand how it's important for us to take care of these victims of domestic violence. And I'm not saying that there's no way that me or you can be victims of domestic violence, because there is a possibility. Things can change, and that can happen, even though you're not planning on it to happen, but it can. So how would you handle that situation if that was to happen to you? Again, I want to give you these two numbers. I have Louisiana Hotline, the 1-800-411-1333, and then there's the National Hotline, which is 1-800-799-SAFE or 1-800-799-7233. And if you want to call in with any questions, you can call in at 347-677-1749. Now, let's see, any more information I would like to give you from this census? Let's see. We talked about not enough staff, limited funding, how important it is for us to, if we can, we can give to these programs. As you know, even the staffing, the amount of money or the salary that a staffer makes is very low. What, $24,000, less than $25,000 a year. So you have to look at that. You have to look at the transportation costs, limited legal services. You know, it's a lot. In the process of all those, you also have to think about needed substance abuse and mental health services also fall into the gamut. The economic crisis, what we talked about, national disasters can really, really have an impact on how we handle domestic violence and the services that we give to our victims. Now I want to go into talking about the history behind domestic violence. And this comes from the Minnesota Center Against Violence and Abuse. And we're going to start with, it's called the Her Story of Domestic Violence. Okay, the year is 253 B.C. During the reign of Romulus in Rome, wife beating is accepted and condoned under the laws of chastisement. Under these laws, the husband has absolute rights to physically discipline his wife. Since by law a husband is held liable for crimes committed by his wife, this law was designed to protect the husband from harm caused by the wife's action. These laws permit the husband to beat his wife with a rod or switch as long as its circumference is no greater than the girth of the base of a man's right thumb, hence the rule of thumb. The tradition of these laws is perpetuated in English common law and throughout most of Europe. Isn't that amazing? In 202 B.C., at the end of the Punic Wars, the family structure changes, giving women more freedom, including property rights and the right to sue their husbands for unjustified beatings. In 300 A.D., the church fathers reestablished a husband's patriarchal authority in the patriarchal values of Roman and Jewish law. The Roman Emperor Constantine the Great had his wife burned alive when she no longer was of use to him. Isn't that something? Middle Ages. In Europe, squires and noblemen beat their wives as regularly as they beat their serfs, which is their slaves. The peasants faithfully followed their lord's example. The church sanctions the subjection of women. Priests advised abused wives to win their husband's goodwill through increased devotion and obedience. Excuse me for one second. Okay. Where was I? Just a second here. Okay. Okay. The church sanctions the subjection of women. Priests advised abused wives to win their husband's goodwill through increased devotion and obedience. The habit of looking upon women as a species apart without the same feelings and capacity for suffering which men possessed becomes inbred during the Middle Ages. In a medieval theological manual, a man is given permission to castigate his wife and beat her for correction. Woo! That's in the Middle Ages from 9 to 1300. The 1400s, the Christian church vacillates between support of wife beating and encouraging husbands to be more compassionate and using moderation in their punishments of their wives. A medieval Christian scholar, Friar Chrysostom of Syria, writes Rules of Marriage in Support of Wife Beating. Let's go down to 1824. A decision by the Mississippi Supreme Court in Bradley versus State, Mississippi, Walker allows a husband to administer only moderate chastisement in cases of emergency. That's in Mississippi. Then in 1845, Sweden passes an inheritance law that gives women and men equal inheritance rights. So a lot of that in that area was able to not happen. In 1829, in England, a husband's absolute power of chastisement is abolished. So it was done away with. Let's see. In 1857, a Massachusetts court is the first to recognize spousal rape exemption. The court in Commonwealth Fogarty relies society solely on Lord Hale's statement in recognizing in declum that marriage to the victim was a defense to rape. Isn't that something? In 1866, the American Society for Prevention of Cruelty to Animals is formed. It predates the founding of the Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Children, established in 1875. Both predate any organization aimed at preventing cruelty to women. Okay. It says, a man in North Carolina is acquitted of giving his wife three licks with a switch about the size of one of his fingers, but smaller than his thumb. The reviewing appellate court later upheld the acquittal on the grounds that the court should not interfere with family government in trifling cases. That happened in 1867. Let's get closer to today, late 1800s. In 1905, in Texas, Frazier versus State, a husband is convicted of assault with the intent to commit rape. The appellate court overturns the conviction by essentially restating Lord Hale's rule of immunity from the 1500s. Whew. This is some real interesting stuff about the history of a woman. And I guess that's why it's called Her Story. In 1962, in New York, domestic violence cases are transferred from criminal court to family court, where only civil procedures apply. The husband never faces the harsher penalties he would suffer if found guilty in criminal court for assaulting a stranger. So do you see how the laws just continue to change, and how it's important for us to keep up with our state laws when it comes to domestic violence, because they do change. And it's amazing that it comes from way back, and it began in 753 BC. So women have been going through a lot through these years. That is a lot of years to think about. Now, let's talk about domestic violence, common victim attitudes and beliefs. We have low self-esteem and feeling of shame, self-blame for abuser's action, believes the myths about battering relationships, and believes the batterer when they use these myths as excuses for behavior. Is a traditionalist about the home, suffers from guilt, yet denies feeling of terror and anger. So a victim comes upon a lot of things when this thing happens to them, when a situation happens to them, what goes to their mind. You know, you never know, because if you don't stand in their shoes or you've never been a victim of that, you wouldn't understand what they go through. They have severe stress reactions with psychological complaints, believe that no one will be able to help or resolve the predicament, and goes through cycles of assistance. So I know that sounds like, you know, how can they assist? Because they have no other way of thinking. This person has beat them down to the lowest they could beat them. So they have no, they feel that there's no help for them, and nobody's going to help them regardless. And because the abuser has put all this in their mind, it's kind of hard for them to get over that hump. So being a victim of domestic violence is not a thing to play with. And we have to be very careful when we talk to people who have been victims of domestic violence, because we know, why are you putting up with this? You shouldn't put up with this. It's easy for us to say. It really is, because we're not standing in their shoes. And we're not walking in their shoes. And we don't have children that are actually watching this happen. You know, it's hard for us on the outside to see how a person who's going through it on a daily basis is feeling. You know, it's hard. Another thing I wanted to talk about while we're talking about that, I wanted to talk about the characteristics of a batterer. After we've talked about domestic violence, common victim attitudes and beliefs, let's talk about the characteristics of a batterer. Let's see. They also have low self-esteem. They rush into different relationships, excessively jealous. They don't want you with nobody. You know, they're watching everything you do, exhibit controlling behavior. They have unrealistic expectations or demands. You know, it's amazing, you know, the things that they go through. Use isolation to keep you under control. They believe in male supremacy and stereotype masculine role in the family. What gets me is when people use, I'm the head of the household. So I say to anybody who says, I'm the head of the household, now, are you truly the head of the household, or are you the warden of the household? And they look at me and say, what? No, let me say this again. What do you consider, or let me ask you this question, what do you consider the head of the household? And when you use that phrase, head of the household, does that mean that you're the head of the household in the sense that you'll sacrifice your whole everything for your family? Or does it mean that your family is totally under your control? Now, according to what it says in the Bible, it's totally different from the way man has interpreted the phrase, head of the household. And to me, that bothers me, because the head of the household is a person. They make some of the decisions, And when I say some, because when you have a wife, it's equal, so there really isn't a head of the household. This is my belief. This is not what I want everyone else to believe about the head of the household, and I'm not pushing my belief on anybody. I'm just explaining to you what I interpret with the head of the household. I think it's two heads to the household because it should be two people making the decisions, not just one, because there's no longer a one person working in the family. So I think if I'm equally bringing home the bacon and he is bringing home the bacon, then we both should be able to sit down and make decisions together. And we should both agree to situations and things together. It shouldn't be all about him making decisions. It should be us together making a decision. And it shouldn't be that whatever he says goes. Because sometimes, and believe it or not, the man is not always right. Like they say, the customer is always right. The man is not always right. Sometimes they make mistakes. So in order for you not to go through that, I think sitting down with both of you together, making a decision that's going to affect the family in some kind of way. Let me get off my soapbox of the head of the household thing. Another thing is the use of force during sex, rough sex. If you don't agree to rough sex, then it shouldn't be rough sex, period. They have poor communication skills. That goes with the isolation. If I can keep her away from anybody, nobody can talk to her. Then they don't talk to you. They cut you off. And when a man doesn't want to talk to you, don't keep nagging at him. Leave him alone. Let him be him. Because sometimes that's what it takes. They need to deal with themselves. And you need to let them go. Don't keep whining. Keep complaining and trying to get their attention, because sometimes the attention that you're trying to get is not positive attention, it's negative attention, you know. If he doesn't want to be bothered, leave him alone. That can avoid a lot of stuff that goes on, you know, because women, sometimes we're so used to being the victim that we automatically play the role and then we become the victim all over again when we don't have to. So sometimes it's just best that you, because you know he had poor communication skills, allow him to deal with that on his end, you know. So just kind of be careful sometimes when it comes to nagging them. They use negative behavior, drugs, alcohol, battering to cope with stress, you know, loss of job, like we were talking earlier about economic situations. All of this has an effect on how a man, because a man is told he's not supposed to cry, he's not supposed to, you know, get angry, he's supposed to just take the whole burden of life on his shoulder and not get any help and just deal with it. Well, men can break down too, and they don't handle things like women do. We can handle probably more stress than they can. So they have to find an outlet, and their outlet, if you're there, either punching bag, like it says, drugs, alcohol. So they've got to find a way to let all this stress out. Don't add to it by nagging. And I hate to use that word because my husband probably gets the interpretation that I sometimes, the impression that I sometimes nag. But the best thing to do is just let them go through what they want. But it still doesn't allow or make it right for him to make you his punching bag when he is stressed out. They just need other coping mechanisms in place when they do go through stress. They blame others, like, you see, I didn't have to punch you if you would just do what I say, you know. They're blaming you for their violence or their abuse. They have two different personalities, the good one and the bad one. Which is funny, you know. Last but not least, they exhibit cruelty to animals or children. I'll tell any woman, I love children, but if you know your partner is abusing your children, you need to get out that situation. You definitely need to get out that situation. Some way, shape, form, or fashion, you need to get out that situation. It's not worth it. No way, shape, form, or fashion. Is it worth you going or allowing someone to hurt your children? And any mother who loves her children is going to do the best she can to protect her children. If that's taking the beatings herself, she will do it. Now, let's talk about separation violence. Battered women seek medical attention for injuries sustained as a consequence of domestic violence significantly more often after separation than during cohabitation. About 75% of the visits to emergency rooms by battered women occur after separation. About 75% of the calls to law enforcement for intervention and assistance in domestic violence occur after separation from batterers. One study revealed that the half of the homicides of female spouses and partners were committed by men after separation from batterers. Because leaving may be dangerous from the point that the batterer learns that the relationship may end, does not mean that the victim should stay. Cohabiting with the batterer is highly dangerous, both as violence usually increases in frequency and severity over time, as the batterer may engage in preemptive strikes, fearing abandonment or anticipating separation even before the victim reaches such a decision. Although leaving may pose additional hazards, at least in the short run, the research data demonstrates that ultimately victims can best achieve safety and freedom apart from the batterer. Leaving will require strategic planning and legal intervention to avert separation violence and to safeguard victims and their children. You need to work on a safety plan. Now, let's talk about a safety plan, a domestic violence safety plan. Very, very interesting. And all this information I'm getting is from the Abuse, Rape, and Domestic Violence Aid and Resource Collection. Okay? And it's called aardvark.org. Now, we'll talk about the following steps, which represent for increasing my safety and preparing and advance for the possibility for further violence. Although I do not have control over my partner's violence, I do have a choice about how to respond to situations and how to best get myself and my children to safety. By no means, this is a list of comprehensive and not all the things on the list may apply to me in my unique situation or you in your unique situation. Having these and other steps done ahead of time can make the decision to leave easier when an opportunity presents itself or my physical safety demands it. In addition, it may give me some peace of mind and a sense of regaining some control over my life again. My local domestic violence program is available to assist me with safety planning, either in person or over the phone. I do not have to give my name or other identifying information. I can utilize their free service as part of my overall safety plan. Again, I will give you the Louisiana hotline and the national hotline, which is 1-800-411-1333. The national hotline is 1-800-799-SAFE or 1-800-799-7233. To call me is 347-677-1749. All right, step one, safety during a violent incident. I can always avoid violent incident. In order to increase safety, I can use some of or all the following strategies. A, practice how to get out safely. What doors, windows, elevators, stairwells, or fire escapes would I use? Now, B, I can keep my purse and keys ready, always being sure to keep them in a certain place so that I can leave quickly. I can also leave a set of keys with a trusted friend or relative. I will make sure they know why, so they don't accidentally let it slip if my abuser talks with them. I can put a set in my desk drawer at work or hidden somewhere on the outside of my home. I can get a magnetic key box that attaches under the fender of my car. Now, see, I can tell certain neighbors about the situation and request they call the police if they hear suspicious noises coming from my house. I can teach my children how to use the telephone to contact police and medical help by using 911. I can make sure my children know their full names, our address, and other important information in case they need to call for help or we get separated because of violence. I can teach my children to run to a neighbor's house or a nearby public place if violence occurs. Because I might be in danger and not able to talk freely, I will devise a code for my children, family, friends, or coworkers, so they will know that I need them to call for help on my behalf. For example, I might say that today is my cousin Shirley's birthday. I don't have a cousin, so my support system will know that if I use this phrase, I might be in danger. Since I might have to leave my home quickly, I should be aware of where I might go in an emergency. I need to select public places, preferably places that are open 24 hours a day and close to my home. Hospital, convenience stores, restaurants, grocery stores are likely to be open. Have pay phones where I can dial 111 for help and room inside for me to wait for the police to arrive. G, when I believe that an argument or violence are about to happen, I can minimize the risk of physical injury to myself by trying to get to a room that has access to an outside door, by avoiding rooms that provide easy weapons for my abuser, such as knives in the kitchen, or fighting in rooms where an abuser keeps a gun, or rooms where I might be trapped, such as the bathroom. Since bathroom doors are usually not reinforced, they are very easy to kick in. This is all part of step one. Step two, making it easier to leave. When I leave the residence I share with an abuser, I must plan carefully to increase safety for myself and my children. If my abuser believes that I am trying to escape, they may strike back or increase the violence to try to get me to stay. I can use some or all of the following safety strategies. A, in order to increase my ability to identify myself and my children to apply for various types of aid and assistance to keep me from having to return to the residence and possibly confront the angry abuser, I will keep photocopies of important documents that I can grab quickly if I need to leave. Identification for myself, children's birth certificates, my birth certificates, social security cards, school and vaccination records, money, checks, ATM cards, credit cards, keys, house, car, and office, driver's license and registration, welfare identification, work permits, green cards, passports, divorce papers, medical records, lease, rental agreements, deeds, mortgage paper, payment book, bank books, insurance papers, pet licenses, vet receipts or paperwork establishing your ownership, password on any online accounts. This website provides a worksheet for tracking important information that should have with me when leaving. Boy, I'm having time reading today or tonight. Okay, that was A. With B, I will be calmer and feel more in control under stress if I am aware of resources waiting to help me. If I know how to contact them and have an idea of the assistance available to me, I can either ask the police to help me get to safety with friends or family, or I can contact my local domestic violence program. I can keep change for phone calls on me at all times, which, you know, now we don't have public phones, so this information is probably a little bit older. Now we have cell phones, so it would be good for us to have a cell phone available. If you don't have a cell phone on the same plan that he might have or she might have, it's best to get a track phone, a prepaid phone, with a separate number from the number that you got that he knows or she knows already. I can keep change for phone calls on me at all times. I should not use telephone calling card linked to my phone bill because my abuser will be able to tell what friends, families, or other numbers I have called. To keep my communications private, I will use change or prepaid calling cards, like I said earlier. For cheap call, you can get a track phone, like I said, or a to-go phone, and buy the card. Keep the card in a safe place with all the other information that you're going to need. And that phone, keep all that stuff in a safe area, so when it's time for you to go, you have all that stuff ready for you. You can use your phone, and he's not able to trace that phone, or she's not able to. I don't want to always say it's him, because there could be a female abuser at the same time. D, if my abuser is not arrested at the time of the violent incident, I cannot be sure that it will be safe for me to return home to pick up items I might need in order to be prepared. I can leave an extra set of clothes for myself and my children and several days of any required medications at a certain place. E, if I need to return to my residence, I will call my local police or sheriff and request a domestic violence standby to ensure my safety. I will go to a place close to my residence and call to have them meet me there. They will follow me to my residence and wait while I collect some things. I will make sure to ask the officer for a business card or a name and a badge number. I might also fill this officer in on the circumstances and ask them to keep an extra eye on my residence. So you make sure you have those phone numbers on you too. Items that I need to take with me at that time should also include medication, children's favorite toys or blankets, small sellable items, address book, pictures, jewelry, items of special sentiment or value. And that's another way of identifying you. I hate to say it like that, but it's another way of identifying you when you have these items also, just in case the violence increases and gets to a dangerous level. Step 3. Safety in my own residence. Once I am able to return home or obtain alternate housing, there are many things I can do to increase safety in my own residence. It may be impossible to do everything at once, but safety measures can be added step by step. Safety measures I can use can include the following. A, I can change the locks on my doors and windows as soon as possible. B, I can replace wooden doors with steel metal doors. C, I can install security systems, including additional locks, window bars, poles to wedge against doors, an electronic system. I might be able to get a free security system from ADT Security. I will ask my local domestic violence program for information, and that's a good thing. They might not charge you if they know your situation. D, I can purchase rope ladders to be used for escape from second floor windows. E, I can install smoke detectors and purchase fire extinguishers for each floor in my house or apartment. F, I can install an outside lighting system that lights up when a person is coming close to my house. G, I can use a panic button system from ADT to alert authorities that I am in imminent danger. Be sure to speak with advocates at your local law enforcement agents and or domestic violence program about these steps. Often there are programs that can help get these things done for you or cover the cost, which is very important. Step 4 is safety with an order of protection, which in my previous segments we talked about the order of protection twice. So we know that's very important to have. It is possible for me to know if my abuser will obey a protection order or not. I recognize that I may need to ask the police and the court to enforce my protection order. The following are some steps that I can take to help the enforcement of my protection order. I will keep my protection order on me, near me at all times. I can also keep copies in the car, at the office, etc., wherever I'm located it's best to leave a copy of the protective orders. I will give copies of my protective orders to the police department in the communities where I usually visit, family and friends in the community where I also live. Remember, we talked about that earlier. C, for further safety, if I often visit other counties in my area, I might file my protection order with that county, the court in those counties also. D, I can check to make sure my order is listed in the registries of counties where I live and work by calling the clerk of court and the sheriff's office for each county. I can call the local domestic violence program if I am not sure about any items above or if I have some problem with my protection order. F, if I can inform my employer, my minister, my closest friend, and others that I have a protection order in effect, which is very good. G, if my protection order gets lost or stolen, I can get another copy. Always be able to get another copy of that. You don't want to be without that. H, if my protection order is violated, I can call the police and report a violation. Contact my attorney, call my advocate, or advise the court of the violation. If the police do not help, I can contact my advocate or attorney, and will file a complaint with the chief of police department or the county sheriff office. The laws now have changed so much where now the police have to get involved in a lot of situations when there used to be they weren't. I can also file a private criminal complaint with the district justice in the jurisdiction where the violation occurred or with the district attorney. I can charge my abuser with a violation of the order of protection and all the crimes that he or she commits in violating the order. I can call my local domestic violence advocate to help me with all of this information because a lot of this stuff can be overwhelming and you are going to need assistance. Step five, safety on the job and in public. Relationship violence is the number one cause of death of women in the workplace. While it might be important for me to try to continue to work during the situation, I might be at continued risk from violence from my abuser. My employer and coworkers can help to protect me if I inform them on the situation. I might do any or all the following. A, I can inform my boss, my secretary, the security supervisor in the police department near my office of my situation. B, I can ask coworkers to help screen my telephone calls at work. C, when leaving work, I can try to leave with the other people in, or I can ask security walk me out. If I know I will be leaving after dark or working late, I can move my car closer to the entrance while at lunch or on my break. D, if problems occur when driving around, I can flag down a law enforcement officer or other public safety officials, drive to a local hospital, or get some other public place. Whenever you think you're being followed and you know this person is your abuser, it's best to stay in a place where there are people, in a public area. Somebody will stop and help you. You know, they say in some places they won't. But some people will stop. A hospital, a grocery store, you're on your lunch break, the restaurant you're in, somebody will help you as long as you're around people because you have witnesses, okay? Now, E, if I use public transit, I can get off at a different stop than my abuser might expect. Inform the driver that someone might be stalking me or wait to exit until I see that other people will be exiting also. That's why it's very important for you to be in the public's eye. I might go to a different grocery store and shopping malls to conduct my businesses and shop at hours that are different than those when residing with my abuser. So that means you be around lots and lots of people and during the daytime. Don't do a lot of nighttime shopping or lounging around or whatever you're doing. Make sure you do it during the daytime in the middle where everyone can see you. G, I can use a different bank and take care of my banking hours different from those I use when residing with my abuser. Arrange for direct deposit or ask a trusted coworker to take my deposit for me. Now, if you do have direct deposit, you might have to change all your information on your banking. You can do a lot of transactions online now, so things have changed. and where he can't get a hold to any, you take him off of any of the accounts you have with him. Because as long as he can get to your money, then he can stop you from making a move. Make sure you always have extra money on you. Always save something. Put something to the side. Step six, and I might have to continue this along with our last segment, which will be July 23rd, which is next week, where we'll start talking about men as victims. We talked about women as victims. Let's talk about men as victims. And that will be our next segment. And that's for next week. Step six is safety when using drugs or alcohol. It says the legal consequences of using or possessing illegal drugs can hurt my relationship with my children and put me at a disadvantage or, in other legal actions concerning my abuser or the custody of my children. The use of any alcohol or other drugs can reduce my ability to act quickly to protect myself and my children from an abuser. I can enhance safety for myself and my children by A, if I am going to use drugs or alcohol, I can do so in a safe place and with people who understand the risk of violence against me and are committed to my safety. I don't understand that one, but okay. B, if I am going to use drugs or alcohol, I need to do so apart from my children after I have arranged for them to be in the care of a competent adult. If I am going to use drugs, this is C, or alcohol, I need to ensure that I have a safe way to return home, such as a designated driver. D, if I'm using drugs or alcohol to cope with anxiety, depression, or stress, I can help to ensure my ability to care for myself and my children by finding better coping mechanisms and replacing destructive behavior with more positive activities, such as joining a support group, increasing my exercise, and finding activities that I can do with my children. Very important. Okay, step six is talking about safety with my children. A, in the event that my partner takes my children, I will teach my children how to use the telephone to call me, including how to call collect and how to use 911. I can make sure that if my child has a cell phone, that they have multiple numbers my child can use to contact me. I can disguise some of these numbers in case my partner erases my numbers, like listing my numbers under school bus or other names my partner isn't likely to consider. B is I will tell people who take care of my children what persons have permission to pick up my children and that my partner is not permitted to do so. If I have custody order, I need to give copies to schools and after-school programs, sport programs, etc. Your daycare staff, babysitter, Sunday school teacher, principal, and it goes on and on. These are the people who have permission to pick up my child if I don't show up at a certain time. C, I can inform neighbors, pastors, and friends that my partner no longer resides with me and they should call the police if they observe them near my residence. I think that's very important. D, if immigration issues exist or if I believe my partner may try to leave the country with my children, I can contact the U.S. Department of State Office and Children's Issues. And that number for that one is 1-888-407-4747 to assure that a visa or passport cannot be obtained for the children. I can also ask their help in contacting the embassy for the country my partner might try to flee to for the same reason. I never thought about that. So that's another number I would like to add to my list of numbers to know. That number is 1-888-407-4747, and that's the number of Department of State Office of Children's Issue. Just in case your child is being taken out of the country, you're informing them that your child cannot leave the country, and it's also to make sure that a passport or any type of visa has been given at that time. Okay, we talk about the step eight, financial safety and independence. I realize that financial control is one of the biggest factors that could keep me tied to an abusive relationship. A, not only does lack of my own personal money cause stress for me and reduce the options for myself and my children, but the lack of privacy around my money, can be another way that my partner monitors me or tries to control me. My partner might be able to monitor my spending and gain information about my activities and my location. I can protect my privacy by using cash or limiting the use of credit cards, since my partner might be able to see my transactions online or might have enough information to access my account by phone. That's why I believe in this, and this is just me personally. Always have a separate account with all your information on it. Okay, let me say that again. Always have a separate account with extra money in it and all your information. Online, wherever you want to keep it, but always have something separate from what your abuser has. And, you know, I know, understand that some people say, oh, I've been married to my husband, but I trust him, trust him. I'm just saying me. Always have a separate account from the person that you're married to or you have a relationship to. Don't put all your eggs in one basket with their names on it, because you have to work to get those names off of it. I don't care what nobody says. You have to work to get them out. And if they don't sign the paperwork to give you permission to take their name off of it, guess what? They have access. And the best thing to do, if you have an account with that person, is close that account. That's the best way to do it, is to close that account or take the money out. And don't put any more money in that account, okay? Talking with your bank or looking online to see if my account can be accessed or monitored via the Internet, then changing any passwords or restricting online access, just as with cell phones. If my partner's name is on the account, they can show photo ID at the bank and gain access again. So that's why I say separate yourself from all of that. Stashing enough cash to cover several days in a hotel and meals just in case you need it. B, to increase my independence, I can open a savings account. If I am concerned that my abuser will find out, I will use my work address or friend's address to keep this account private, or I can visit, you can open a savings account that operates entirely online, so no account statements will arrive in the mail. There are no fees or no minimum to open an account online. So, and these are different ideals and things you can go through. We have some more safety tips. I think this is very good information, and I really, really would like to share this with a lot more people. And I'm hoping someone is out there listening to me and understanding the information that I'm getting. I'm reading a lot because this is a lot of information that I just could not memorize off the top of my head. It would be good to have a guest that deals with domestic violence to give us more information. The hotline for Louisiana, and like I said, I'm in Louisiana, is 1-800-411-1333. The national hotline is 1-800-799-SAFE, S-A-F-E, 1-800-799-7233, and the U.S. Department of State Office of Children's issue is 1-888-407-4747. You can contact me or get drop me a line at www.tag.com, Sleeta B. McCall, or you can get www.facebook.com, Sleeta McCall, Black Planet at Benny64. And we'll talk later. I'll see you next week. Thank you guys for listening in. And have a nice evening, and please stay safe. Mm-hmm.